Hey everyone, it's a percussion podcast, and we're recording on December 29th, 2019, and it's episode 211. My name is Casey Cangelosi, and with me, as usual, we've got Carly Vigna.
Hi everyone.
And Ksenia Komjanovic is here.
Hi.
So, Happy New Year, y'all. Do you have any New Year's resolutions or plans or anything like that?
You know, Casey, I think you're going to have to check back in with me next week, because one of them might have to be not procrastinating. And I have so many ideas for resolutions this year. Usually I don't really do it, but I've been thinking like all month, like, oh, I got to do this and this. I got to sit down and make a list. There's so many. So next week.
Okay, I'll ask you next week. You know, we're recording next week's in about an hour, right?
Okay, 2 weeks.
So I've reported on this before, actually, and just the so I won't repeat it all. But yeah, it's very interesting just how many New Year's resolutions fall flat. It's like very, very high percentage of people can't maintain their New Year's resolutions. And it sounds like the main reason is because they aren't realistic goals. They're too vague, and they aren't, according to what I read and reported on before, they're not, quote, affirmed in the positive. So if you look up online, like how to make your New Year's resolution goal work or whatever, it seems like the thing they always point to is weight loss, I guess because that's a very common goal. But something they say, like to affirm something in the positive, you don't just say, I'm gonna not be so heavy. You say something more specific, like I'm going to go on a walk for 10 minutes every other day or something. And it's also realistic. You don't just say, I'm gonna lose weight, period. That's affirmed in the positive, and that's what you're going to do. But it's way too vague and just not planned out enough. So if your goal is I'm going to get better at percussion, is too non-specific and it's too broad. You need to say something like, you know what, I procrastinate practicing way too much, so what I'm going to do is practice 10 minutes of this every morning and then again at lunchtime or something. So it's a goal you can track and see your progress on. So, anywho, but let me introduce our guest on episode 211. We've got Conrado Moya with us. He's joining us from Spain. I think he's home seeing his family, and he's just all over the place performing solo recitals, concertos, chamber concerts, Percussive Art Society International Convention, the Guatemala and International Mercedes-Benz Festival in Shanghai. The International Marimba Festival in Guatemala and the International Mercedes-Benz Music Festival in Shanghai. He performs with our good friend and one of my dear heroes, Katarzyna Miszka, and so much more that Conrado does. And yeah, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to the show, Conrado.
Thank you, and hi to everybody. It's my pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, you're very welcome. How about a New Year's goal? Do you have one?
I have a lot, I think.
Like Carly.
Exactly. I have to do many things. Actually, right now I have a lot of plans for 2020, which I hope they will go all well. And as you said, actually, I'm specifying every single step that I need to do. Otherwise, I will get lost completely. So, yeah, I'm programming right now. Yeah.
Can you share one or two?
Oh, well, for now, actually, I have to make some CD recording in January between 8 concerts with Katarzyna Miszka and also with the Marimba Quartet. So, yeah, I hope to survive to this, and then we will have other things. Yeah.
Cool. I forgot to say you're a Marimba One artist. I need to do
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of Marimba One buddies here in the room and also listen to the show. So that's very cool. Cool. Ksenia, I think you might have a question.
So I wanted to open up with your education, Conrado. If you would tell us a little bit about your mentors. You studied in Spain, but then you went to Germany, right? You studied with Kaszka and you studied with Li Biao. Would you like to share with us a little bit of compare and contrast? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, actually, I always try to explain a little bit about myself, because when I was a kid, I was completely fascinated with percussion, you know, since I was 2 years old, actually, and I was destroying all the pots of my mother and everything in the kitchen, you know. And I remember when I was, I don't remember exactly, 8 or 9 years old, and I was at the high school or music school. And the professor, the teacher, percussion teacher, introduced me to the marimba, and I didn't like it at all, really, because it was just too difficult for me. Oh. Really. Yeah. So it was actually a big problem for me, the marimba. But then I was growing up with these instruments, and of course I was forced to play every instrument, every percussion instrument, right? Like every percussionist. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 14, something like that, I completely got in love of this instrument, and I remember my professor, I already started with one amazing percussionist and soloist in Spain. His name is Cisco Parisi. He's very specific for contemporary music. And I remember with him, I discovered the marimba and what marimba could do, no, but in a real way, not in a school way. Yeah? So then from this moment, I got completely in love of marimba. And I think it has also something to be, because I was always very connected to the piano and on the other side with the percussion. So I think marimba for me was exactly the middle point between both of them, right? Huh. And then it was when I was 15 years old, 16 years old, when I got the first CD of Katarzyna Miczka Kaszka for friends. Yeah, you all know her. And that was, I think, for me, the biggest light in my life, that this was the sound that I really wanted to have, the way of expressing, you know, something. It really shocked me. Uh-huh. So I was asking Cisco, please, you need to bring her to Spain. I need to have a masterclass with her. And I was very obsessive with that. So at the end, he brought Kaszka. I had my first masterclass, and in the first masterclass I said, of course, I want to have a lesson with you, but she was not, at that time, she was not teaching in any university. Mm-hmm. So then she offered me to go to her home in Stuttgart, Germany. Mm-hmm. And then I was just having private lessons for, I don't remember exactly, but I think 7 years or something like that, yeah? Mm-hmm. Until I finished my bachelor degree. I made my bachelor degree in Alicante. Mm-hmm. But with 16, I already decided that I wanted to be marimbist, and I wanted to make these specific studies with her, right? So I was going every 1.5 months somehow, preparing a different program and going to her and preparing these, you know, single pieces, solo pieces. And then when I finished the bachelor is when I went to Berlin, at the Hans Eisler Hochschule University. First of all, I was fascinated by Germany and Berlin, the musical or cultural life that this country have. It's just amazing. And you can learn from any concert that you have. Every day you have concerts, and they, you know, it's so active. So I was learning so much from many, not just marimbas, but, you know, any instrumentalists. Yeah. And then, of course, I had the pleasure to work with 3 amazing percussionists. One of them, as you said, it was Libiao. It's a fantastic percussion soloist, but he's also a conductor right now. He's the chief conductor of Beijing Symphonic Orchestra. So an amazing musician, really. And 2 others that I'm sure you also know is Rainer Siegers, the timpani player from Berliner Philharmonica, and Franz Schindelberg, the percussionist from Berliner Philharmonica. So it was such a great experience to work with them. You know, they have such a big experience at this amazing orchestra with amazing conductors and, you know, any soloist that is playing with them. So I got a lot of information, a real information with them. And that was very important for me, actually. And also working with Kaszka, you know, working with a soloist that is so active as Kaszka is, no? That she has so many projects and everything. I got so much information about the reality of being soloist, not just the dream of being soloist, but without knowing what it really means, right? So I always felt very, very lucky to have these professors, actually. Yeah.
She is really lovely. And not only is she lovely, as you said, she's very realistic, which really helps people who work with her, because she truly helps people get in the not the business of it, but in the reality of it. But I was going to ask you a quick follow-up. When you went to Hans Eisler, did you actually get to continue your marimba focus, or did you have to stay diversified? How did that go?
Well, actually, my idea was to continue with my marimba, you know, my marimba world, my marimba education. But at that time, I also realized that my problem, especially in Spain, it was that I was missing a lot of reality of music, but the music world, not just percussion world, but the music world. No? And Berlin was for me the perfect choice, because anyone who is playing in Europe, at the end, they go to Berlin and they play in Berlin. So if you want to meet someone, so, any artist, they somehow go to Berlin in any moment, right? So when I went to Berlin, of course, it was to keep or to continue with my education, but also to open my mind to the reality of the music world and get out a little bit of the percussion world, which I didn't know that it was kind of, I don't want to say small, but it's smaller than the music world, right? And when you get into the music world, you realize, wow, now I need to learn a lot, right? And Berlin was the perfect point for that. But I have to say that in Berlin, it's still not allowed to work just in marimba. I mean, you cannot specify just in marimba. So I needed to do also the other instruments, but I could focus on percussion solo repertoire. So I didn't need to do any orchestral studying, because I already did for my 4 years of bachelor. In Spain, it's 4 years of bachelor. I don't know there, but I already did 4 years of also orchestral studying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I could focus just in solo and chamber music program. And then I could also decide how much I wanted to do of every instrument. So I didn't need to do exactly the same with snare drum than with timpani or with multi-percussion or marimba. So as you can imagine, I decided like 80% marimba and all the others was percussion. Yeah. Because it was already a lot for me. Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, and I guess sort of a question for everybody, but Conrado, you mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, you didn't like marimba at first, and then as you got to know it a little more, you like really, really fell in love with it. And I think a lot of percussionists, they really... I mean, we just like love marimba, and it seems like it's such a new focus, and suddenly has this, its own chronology and its own track of progress almost outside of the rest of percussion. And I know I've had a lot of friends and colleagues who aren't percussionists, and actually some even percussionists say, like, what is y'all's obsession with the marimba? Like, what is the deal? It's not in any of the major rep. It's... you know, it's always buried in the back when it's scored with winds and brass. You never hear it. You know, like they're just kind of confused by our just love and interest of it. And I know how I answer the question, but I want to know, like, how do you three approach that question if you've ever had to answer it?
Well, I think for me, one of the things, it was actually because what I already explained. No, I'm completely in love of piano, and not just in love, but you know, inspired by piano since I was a kid, but also by percussion, by the energy of the percussion, yeah, the percussion family in general. So I think for me, marimba had both of them. I could actually, you know, make all the melodies and harmonies and, you know, counterpoint. I could really express with more than rhythms. But on the other side, I needed this energy and this power that percussion has and any other instrument has. And I think marimba has both of them. So for me, it was the perfect combination, right? But on the other side, I think I was very shocked by the... I remember the first time, it was also because of marimba, one instrument. I was... when you feel, or when as a kid, you feel surrounded by this sound, the projection of this instrument. I was just in love, you know. I said, okay, this is what I want to do. Absolutely. I want to produce the sound. And I'm a completely obsessive also of the sound, and different sounds and different textures and different dynamics. I love to destroy my mind with this and thinking about that. And a marimba, I think it has also this, no? The range, for example, of dynamics of the projection or the body sound that you can produce is super. I mean, you have so many different, how to say that, like ideas, but to develop, right? And you have a big world to develop on the instrument. So for me, it was the perfect instrument to develop all what I was feeling or all what I was imagining. So I think I felt in a way that the future was open for me in this instrument. Yeah.
Very cool. Anybody else?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I would echo some of what Conrado said, and I don't normally find I have to justify why we love the marimba to, you know, colleagues or friends, but sometimes to students that might feel a little bit like, why am I doing this? I want to be an orchestral player, or I'm just going to be a band director, not just, but sometimes like you said, like the learning curve is steep and it can feel like, wow, this is hard. Why do I have to do this? And for me, it's our vehicle, like Conrado said, for playing melody and harmony at the same time. And for also discovering so much of the repertoire, like on marimba, we play music from basically all eras of music history and common practice. And we learn, you know, what these chord progressions sound like and feel like, and we phrase in a way that's different from snare drum and timpani. Of course, I totally agree with the marimba one sound. What a beautiful instrument. But yeah, that's what it is for me. It's funny because
shush, amen.
Because some of this,
we have to do that.
Well, some of this people might even consider impractical advice for young people who, you know, maybe are going to be freelancing or looking for an orchestral job. Like, why do we spend so much time on four mallets, and why do we learn Reflections on the Nature of Water if later you're going to be playing Porgy and Bess and Kiji? But that's what it is for me. Like, it's one way to hugely widen our tools for expression, which, you know, that informs mm-hmm. everything that you do in large ensemble or in chamber settings or anything. It's just a way to broaden our perspective as musicians.
Cool. Yeah. Great answer.
I just fell in love with the color of that sound. I think that the instrument is so earthy in some way. I just love wood and how it sounds. And I mean, what I love about percussion is that there are so many diverse colors. So you can easily, when your ears get saturated of one thing, move on to another and still get your musical juices flowing while not feeling like you're going crazy because of the type of sound that you're creating. But I just think it's not something that I can explain. It's just the thing that I fell in love, and I think it's the coolest sound of, yeah, in any context. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
great. Carly, I think you had something different.
Yeah, kind of a follow-up on something that Conrado said earlier. You were talking about how you got to a point with a marimba where, like, oh, this isn't my favorite instrument, it's really hard. What advice maybe do you have for students that are going through some of those growing pains as far as how to jump into more challenging areas for them?
Well, this is a great question, actually. You know, when I make masterclass, which I love to make masterclass in different countries or parts of the world, because there are completely different, you know, reactions on the marimba, I found out that the common point for everyone, for every human being, is actually the connection with the body, not the connection with the instrument. And if you really work on the body and you really work on how to connect your body or how to understand your body, and then when you understand your body, then you can connect it with any instrument. It doesn't matter if this is marimba, snare drum, or cello, or flute, yeah. Then I think we need to start with this. And this is one of the first questions that I sometimes ask to students when they say, I have a problem with this passage, or I have a problem with this piece, or something. I say, you have a problem with the passage, or you have a problem with your body, you know? And they don't know, because they never think about their body. They always think about the marimba, or the mallets, or the instrument, or whatever, no, the piece, but they never think about themselves. And actually, I think for any instrument it's the same, but for percussion, it's 90% of all we're playing is our body. It's how you understand your body, how do you move, how is your position, how do you feel this, where do you feel it? No, it's not the same to play from, I don't know, putting the weight on the elbow or on the wrist or something, or from the back or something. You feel it completely different, right? Or even if you need to go, I don't know, to play in the lower register on the marimba or the upper register, you need to approach it completely different, in a different way, right? But not so many students think about their body. They just think about, okay, what is in the book written? What is my professor saying or something? But they never think how I feel it. So I think the best point and the best advice for me is always think about how do you feel that? How do you want to feel it? And if you feel it comfortable or natural, organic in a way, or do you feel artificial? If you feel that this is not natural for you in the way you are playing, then maybe we are doing something wrong. And you know, in the marimba world, I think we have it's still such a young instrument, right? And young history. And we have a lot of theories about how to play marimba, but any of them is, you know, older than, I don't know, 60 years, to say something, because we have a lot, yeah? But any of them has like a three centuries history, any of this idea, because we don't have three centuries history with marimba, right? So I think we should not close in any idea or any book or any professor. And this is what I tried to do when I was a kid, and still I try to do it. Always try to see many different marimbas and try to understand how are they connecting with the instrument more than how are they playing this piece concretely. And then from this, we can learn much more, I think, and we can solve problems easily, because you solve it with the knowledge of your body and not with the knowledge of someone playing something. I think it's more natural for me.
Right, yeah. Well, and the physicality of what we do is so connected to the sound that we're making, you know, the every stroke, the speed of the stroke, the way that we're moving, where mm-hmm. we're standing at the instrument, is just so connected. I love that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Even just the first position before playing a note, just the first note when you go. I remember some kids going to the States and just with, you know, very artificial position with the legs very close one to each other, right? I'm feeling very uncomfortable and unstable, right? And I just said, just try to open the legs and then tell me what you feel. And they say, okay, well, I feel more secure. I say, sure, your position is more stable. So just this little idea given to your brain, it gives you a little bit more of relaxed when you're going to play, no? And it's such a stupid example, but it's a lot, actually, when you feel kind of stressed before playing. Having a good position already give you the feeling that you are a little bit more secure on the stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a small example, but I think it's a really good example to understand how the body can influence your brain. Yeah.
I was going to ask, while you're on that, where do you usually see it? Like, what part of the body? Is it usually the legs? Is it sometimes shoulder posture? Like, I know it can be many, many places, but where do you find people aren't thinking about it the most?
Normally, they are thinking about the mallets. This is the worst thing. They don't think about the body. They think about the mallets, and maximum is how am I moving the hands or wrist as maximum, because it's the closest to the mallet, right? So I think this is the biggest problem, that they don't think really what is after the wrist. Everything is somehow in the wrist, hand, and mallets, but they don't think, okay, what about if I just, I don't know, make this position with the back or something, no? Everything will change, but they never think about this part. They always think about this part, right? So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's really smart. I wanted to ask you, so I've been following your career since, because we're about the same age, but I've always mm-hmm. in many ways looked up to you. And even when I remember, you know, seeing you going to ICMA as a student, and then seeing this evolution of your sound and presence and just musical ideas, and especially seeing the grand burst of it when you recorded Anna Ignatovich's Toccata. I remember seeing that video and just mm-hmm. thinking, like, wow, that was awesome. And now you've come to a point in your career and in your pursuit of sound that you have created your own mallets. Can you tell us mm-hmm. about that? How did that come about? What kind of sound you were going for? What's up with that?
Yeah, sure. You know what happened with me with my mallets? I think I can say this here. I'm a little bit a pain in the ass with this with the mallets in general. honestly, because I don't know how much exactly I have, but I can say I have for sure 5 different lines of mallets, which I'm using. No, of course, I have my favorite one. I had my favorite ones that I was using mostly 80%. Yeah. But then I got at least, I don't know, 400 mallet or 300 mallet, I don't know, I never counted single, but a lot of mallet. And I was always trying to find the perfect sound, perfect texture, perfect projection, many things, no? For every piece. And I got frustrated with many of them because I couldn't find it. So then I was asking Ron Samuels from Marimba One, okay, could you please maybe do this mallet for this space for me? And for many years, he was sometimes helping me on, you know, creating a new mallet or something. But then this mallet was working just for this piece or for the other. So at the end, I think he was just bored. And he said, okay, you know, Conrad, we're going to make your mallet. So at the end, you know, because I was every year asking for something new. And then we made my mallets and we were working with different samples, you know, I don't know how many, but a lot of samples for 3 years, almost 3 years, 2.5 years or something like this. And this is actually what I created on this mallet. It was a part that I felt it was empty, you know. It was not a mallet that you can use for everything, because for me, this doesn't exist, honestly. I think in marimba, we can create so many things with different mallets, with different, you know, materials, with different weight, with so many things, that using just one kind of mallet, sometimes it is very limited, honestly. So what I did is a mallet that I was missing, especially for one kind of texture. It's a little bit more, how to say, I was using a very tight mallet, very heavy and very tight mallets, right? So what I tried to do with this mallet, it was a bigger projection, even a bigger projection than the one that I was using. So they are a little bit more heavy, especially the harder ones. Yeah? That normally they are always lighter. These are a little bit heavier. So if I need to play with big orchestra or something or big percussion group, I don't need to play with super hard mallet. With a medium hard mallet, it will already work, you know, and I don't need to destroy the bar, you know, with super hard mallets or almost, yeah. So, and this was one thing. And then the second thing was that sometimes when you play with very tight mallets with nylon, I love this sound, but it's very direct, yeah. So sometimes I was missing this kind of warmer texture. Mm-hmm. So what we tried to find, it was a jar that had some nylon inside, but not the 100%. Just some percentage, but I think it was at the end like 30-40% of this nylon, and then 60 of artificial yarn, and then also we changed the inside mallet, yeah, the nose of the mallet, somehow in the same way of any marimba one mallet, but the shape is different. So especially from the medium to the softer, it's a bigger and wide, so you can play or hit a bigger, you know, part of the mallet, of the bar. Sorry. So somehow the projection is also bigger, but also warmer in a way. Yeah, I think it's not so brilliant with the softer. Yeah, it's a little bit more warm and more intimate somehow. Yeah, and with the harder ones, I was trying to find exactly the opposite, a more brilliant and powerful, and even with more projection, so I could play with big ensembles and, yeah, take care of the bars at the same time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long was the process from when you started the conversation to when they were out?
The process was actually, as I say, very long, and we were many times we didn't know exactly what was not working, because you know when you create something new, you don't know where are you going to end up. You just know what you are imagining and what you wanted, but you never know what is going to be exactly the result, because maybe you are able to do it, maybe not. Yeah. And especially with mallets, it's such a big world, but still there is not a big investigation about it. Yeah. I realized actually that when I started to discuss with Ron Samuel, we realized that there is nothing really written about the investigation of materials, weight, and anything like that, right? It could be a good research to do, yeah, a good investigation to do, actually. And that was a big process, and I realized many things. I learned many things, but I'm still thinking about many things. How to develop maybe next mallets in 20 years or 30 years, now that I have this mallet. I'm already thinking about what is the next step and what are we missing. This is, I think, never ending. Yeah.
Conrado, I saw the video and information on your website about your transcription of the Rodrigo Concerto for piano and orchestra. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear about about the piece, and what were some of the characteristics of the piece that inspired you to think it would work really well on marimba?
Yeah, you know, this was one of my biggest dreams and my biggest challenge until now. And thank you for asking, actually, because this is a really important point of my life. Actually, I never used my career with this because it was not for my career, but for my life, because I feel it very personal. I was looking for something really to introduce marimba in any orchestra or any concert hall. How to say this? Maybe to introduce it in the same way as any pianist or any violin player is introducing his instrument or her instrument. Yeah. And then I was trying to find also something very special for me. So Spanish music, for example, it would be very connected to me. No, it's a very, very natural. But it was very difficult because I was always trying to find something for piano, but piano is a very idiomatic instrument. When you find some composition for the piano, it's very specific for piano, and then maybe you need two marimbas or three marimbas to do it, and sometimes it's for 8 octaves and we have just 5, and you cannot touch this. I mean, you cannot change anything from Rachmaninoff or something like this, because how you're gonna do this? This is just amazing, you know? So Rachmaninoff is such a big composer, so who am I to change anything? No, from him. But then suddenly I found this piano concerto by Joaquin Rodrigo, and there is something very interesting about Rodrigo that not everybody knows, that he was blind. I don't know if you knew about that, but he was blind, he couldn't see. So the great thing about this is that he was not the same kind of virtuoso as the piano concerto, famous piano concertos at that time, like Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Rachmaninoff. No, so he was very focused on melodies, on beautiful melodies, as you all know, like with Aranjuez concerto or something. No, this super beautiful melody. And then he had a really good friend who was asking for many years to compose a piano concerto. An amazing pianist from Portugal is Leopoldo Querol. Then at the end, he decided to compose something for him. And this concerto has a lot of, for example, intervals like octave or fifth or fourth or thirds, yeah? But not like 8 notes at the same time, but maximum 6 or something like this. And even the polyphonic side of this piano part is not so developed, let's say, like they are so complicated. Sorry, not developed, but so complicated as any Chopin or something like that. No? So when I found it and I checked the score, I was like very surprised, because actually it looked already very similar to the marimba way of writing. Yeah. And then, of course, then I said, okay, I need to make this transcription, but I didn't know if the family will allow me, because actually Rodrigo passed away 20 years ago. So they still have the rights to decide if you can do something or not. So then I'm living in Madrid, so I went to the family of Rodrigo, and I was talking with them, and I said, you know, I'm completely in love with this concerto, and I think it looks already very similar to marimba. And it was exactly the 20th anniversary of the death of Joaquin Rodrigo. So I said, I would like actually to do this, not just for marimba, but also for the, like a present to Joaquin Rodrigo, because this concerto, especially because it's not a concerto that is such a virtuoso piano concerto, it was kind of in a drawer, you know, not so many people was playing it. So I think it's a good opportunity to bring it again to the concert halls, to bring it again to the audience and to life, let's say like this, yeah, and to make it known again. And I think also for the marimba, it will give you know, will give us the opportunity to have such a quality, not just for the marimba, but also for the orchestra, because everybody knows how Rodrigo was writing, and he was writing amazing for orchestra. His orchestrations and everything were amazing always. And with this concerto, it's exactly the same. So I was just fascinated, and I said, this could be amazing for everybody, for Rodrigo's, for the concerto, for marimba, I mean, for everybody. So why not? And then at the end, the daughter of Rodrigo said, yeah, for sure, we're going to do it. So,
wow,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, I watched a video about that transcription about the concerto, mm-hmm. and I was in Spanish, so my Spanish is very limited, but you did say that you had to somehow adapt your technique to the mm-hmm. type of texture that you did. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, exactly. For example, I have some examples. Maybe this will help. For example, the fourth movement, everything is with octave, the whole movement, with fortissimo and with an orchestra that has like 70 players or something like this, or like really huge orchestra. And, you know, for pianists, they are very used to it, not to play with octaves. I mean, of course, for them, it's very difficult, but yeah. They are kind of used. But for marimba, it's even more difficult because every octave is different, you know? So we actually don't have this technique. And I needed to really practice how to keep the octave for 5 minutes in such a level, you know, and such a speed and everything, and still take care of the sound, take care of any articulation, be able to do whatever I want, not just play forte and hard, but also to be very sensitive with it or something, you know, to create something completely different to what I play normally when I play octave and any other marimba piece sometimes, no? And this was very, very hard for me. For example, I had back problems at the beginning because I was not used to it. And this was one of the hardest things I ever played, really. I mean, to keep the power of your back while playing this, it's actually very difficult. And I was not used to it. Mm-hmm. So I also needed to train a lot to be able to work on this fourth movement. And on the other side, also the polyphonical side, on the first movement and third movement, left hand and right hand is completely, you know, doing completely different things. And completely polyphonical, but just two voices, maybe not as complicated as any other. But I needed really to practice how to don't miss anything, how to really be able to do everything what is written, because I didn't want to change anything what's written, just adapt it to marimba. That's why I always say this is not exactly a transcription, but an adaptation. I don't know. Can you say this in English?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So an adaptation. No? So somehow I just try to adapt it to the instrument. So I didn't need to take out any note or anything like this. But I, of course, I needed to change my technique because I never played such a crazy thing, no? So I needed to exactly, how to say, not to change, but to develop. I think this is the good thing. I needed to develop some parts of my technique that I never worked on them until now, until this concerto. And that's why I'm also happy, because I think from this concerto, we can continue developing this side, and maybe this will bring to the marimba world or marimba history some new ideas, some new ways. This is the most important for me. As I always try to say, I don't work for my career, but I work for the marimba. It's easier and more honest to work for the instrument and then follow what the world is bringing to you than trying to bring to yourself, to work for yourself and then waiting that something is coming to your life, right? Yeah. It's much for me. It's honest and more natural and more, I think, I don't know how to say, more human, you know, more artistic. Yeah.
Sure. Really beautiful sentiments. I have one more question following up on this. What do you generally look for in pieces that you're considering adapting or transcribing? And are there any red flags that make you steer clear of a certain piece?
You know, somehow after playing so many pieces, and especially because I play a lot of Bach music, Bach, I think, is the best example for me of music that you can just take it and play it on the instrument and it will sound amazing. Yeah. So what I learned from this, it was like, if you need to change many things to make it work on the instrument, it will be very difficult to make it sound good on your instrument. Because maybe it is very idiomatically thought for this instrument specifically, yeah. And sometimes this is, imagine like playing, as we were speaking before, Rachmaninoff piano concerto or something like this, no? Or some Chopin etudes or something. Of course, we can play it, we can divide it and we can play it. But it sounds completely different. And sometimes you feel that it's not connecting to the instrument because it was, in the mind was thinking very focused on how to develop this instrument, right? But there are some other pieces that they are not thought in this way, but more in the musical way, how to write good music, yeah? Bach was the best example for this. how to write music for whatever. Even Bach was changing violin concerto into cembalo concerto and into flute concerto. It was the same concerto, right? And it worked. It worked out perfectly. So I don't know if there is something specific, but after so much played in my life, somehow I feel it. When I find the score and I check the score and I say, okay, this can be, or then I say, okay, no, you know, I would love to play. Of course, I would love to play some Liszt or Scriabin or something. But then I say, you know, I prefer to go to a concerto and see in the concert or listen in the concert by a pianist or something. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's okay, probably a really good move, because I think if you want to participate as a percussionist in, you know, I mean, the touring and visiting with orchestras, I mean, you got to start with concertos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is exactly. And it's actually very difficult because, you know, I realized sometimes when I was talking with conductors, you know, and how to or what to program with the orchestra, they never know exactly how to connect it with the rest of the program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to connect it with Beethoven or Brahms or something different, no? Because they don't know our instrument and our repertoire.
You can just tell them, like, Beethoven has symphonies. Beethoven didn't write for the marimba, and this is a marimba concerto, so they're connected. Yeah.
That's it. So, anyway.
Well, it's funny. You know, we were talking about this actually last episode, like programming and how important is it. And yeah, there's a lot of really good conversation about, like, yeah, do they need to be connected? You know, like, I don't think they need to. You know?
For me, it's exactly the same. But sometimes I think there are too many problems because they don't know the repertoire. They don't know the marimbas because, you know, they know pianists, violin players, whatever. But marimba players are still in a different world. We are trying to get into this world, no? By the music world.
Yeah. Have you ever tried to tell them, like, well, we could just play it without you. You could just not conduct. It'll be fine.
No, I was not that brave yet.
I wonder if someone should try that. Like, well, I don't have a problem with this. You do. Yeah. Hey, well, listen, speaking of, you mentioned Beethoven, and he came up in music history this week. So, Conrado, every week I try to say something that happened in music history on our release date.
Mm-hmm.
And, Beethoven came up. But real quick, so a couple things that came out in music history on January 9th. Thursday, January 9th is when we're releasing. But real quick, Nadia Boulanger, the very famous, amazing teacher of the century, gave her first organ recital in the U.S. at the Wanamaker Auditorium in Philadelphia. This is the first of 26 recitals that she'll give through the end of February. And also in 2006, the very famous musical Phantom of the Opera becomes the largest running Broadway show when it marks its, check this out, 7,486th performance at the Majestic Theater, breaking the record held by Cats.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy. Which is another Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. So anyway, those just real quick. There were a lot of other fun facts, but I had to kind of pick and choose. So also on January 9th, Ludwig von Beethoven in 1816, at age 45, wins custody of his nephew Carl in opposition to Carl's mother. So this poked out to me because I think it's really the most fascinating part of Beethoven's biography and the personal thing of his that probably affected him the most. I mean, some people think it's even more so than his struggle with tinnitus and hearing and his illnesses. They think that his nephew Carl is a much, much bigger deal. And if you actually follow his output around the dates of the trials and the custody battle that he went through, which was a nearly 5-year custody battle, you can actually see his output like fluctuate with how busy he is with this nephew. So a little background first. Beethoven and his two younger brothers named Caspar and Nicholas are the three boys of his parents' seven children. These are the only three that survived infancy out of seven. So the nephew Carl is son of Caspar, And Casper is sometimes also referred to as Carl because that's one of his names as well. But I won't include that because it's too many Carls and pretty confusing. But yeah, so Casper is the middle of the three brothers. He's Beethoven's younger brother. And so, yeah, he is Carl's father, Beethoven's brother, and Joanna's husband. So the husband comes down with tuberculosis and signs a declaration making Beethoven the sole guardian of Carl when he gets very sick. He signs that. And on the very same day, suspiciously, Beethoven gave that family, his brother's family, a loan of 1,500 florins. So Joanna takes security of this money and accepts it and oversees it and all of that. So 2 years later, the brother Casper will die, and he, I guess, amends or redates his will just the day before his death, giving guardianship to both Beethoven and Joanna. So initially, he gave sole custody to Beethoven, and then right before he dies, he gives dual custody guardianship to each of them. So Beethoven and Joanna are in and out of court for nearly 5 years. This starts while Carl, the nephew, is 9 years old. The court they're in is one for nobility and higher class citizens, aristocrats, etc., because I guess that's the class the Beethoven name is in at first. Beethoven wins the first round, but 3 years later, when Carl runs away from the boarding school Beethoven sent him to, he runs away to go find his mother, Joanna. She wins an appeal based on that. The upper court also finds that Beethoven's middle name, V-A-N, Beethoven von, Ludwig von Beethoven, because it's V-A-N and not V-O-N, it's not of nobility, and thus can hand the court case down to a lower court for this particular appeal, which tends to favor the mother. So she wins that appeal. Beethoven appeals that one and wins. Joanna makes one final appeal to the emperor and loses, and this closes the case forever. In 1826, at age 20, Carl, that's the nephew, attempts suicide by, check this out, putting two pistols to his head. One supposedly misfires, and the other bullet just barely grazes his skull. Carl requests that he be returned to his mother's house to recover rather than Beethoven's. And this event, this attempted suicide, and his choosing to go to his mother afterwards is what a lot of scholars think and believe causes Beethoven's real health decline. Sorry, this is really long. So, but I just find it so fascinating. Let's see. So next, this chapter I titled, this segment I titled Beethoven the Asshole. So here it is. So as we all know, Beethoven was a total asshole. Beethoven had no children of his own and was never able to marry any of the women he loved due to their higher social class and his lower standing compared to them. I mean, of course, along with all of his health problems, there's a lot of good reasons for poor Beethoven to be the way he is. But upon winning custody of his nephew Carl, Beethoven forbids Carl from seeing his mother. He insisted Carl become a musician and imposed that Carl continue Beethoven's musical legacy and the family name. Beethoven orders his student Carl Czerny to teach nephew Carl. Czerny tells Beethoven that the boy has no musical talent at all. Beethoven refuses to listen to that. Beethoven continually enrolls Carl in various schools so that he might ultimately be a musician. Carl has no particular talent and or interest in music. He runs away from Beethoven's home several times to go find his mother. One instance, Beethoven even called the police on them, or called, that's not right, you didn't call the police back then, but he went to the police to have Carl forcibly returned from his mother's house back to Beethoven. Carl was subjected to years of citing evidence in court, in and out of court, all while coping with how hard this was on his mother, and also coping with his own knowledge of his father's death, because the custody battle begins right after his father's death. Ultimately, it will take Carl's suicide attempt for Beethoven to realize that he has completely failed as a father. And yeah, it just leads up to this whole event where Carl buys a gun, pawns his wristwatch or pocket watch to buy a second gun, and climbs the Rohenstein ruins, which is like a castle in Austria, where he and Beethoven, Uncle Beethoven, often climbed together, and freaking tries to kill himself. Carl enlists in the military after this and is sent away, and his hair is combed forward in the one and only photo we have of Carl, and the hair combed forward is to cover the scar of the bullet wound, the bullet that hit him but didn't kill him. So let's see, what else? He, Carl, the nephew, does not see Beethoven again after he leaves for the military, but does attend Beethoven's funeral. Okay, this next chapter is called Joanna. Remember, Joanna's the mother. It's called Joanna the Sketchy. So Beethoven is definitely the bad guy in this story, in my point of view. There's like no doubt, and I think that's pretty well, that's pretty well agreed upon. Like, he should have just left all that alone. But this chapter is called Joanna the Sketchy. So Beethoven objected to Joanna marrying her brother from the very beginning, a bunch of reasons, but they include, in 1804, Joanna was accused of theft by her parents. I couldn't find the details. I don't think there's any like conviction or anything super concrete, but I did find that she was accused of it. And then in 1811, this one is more severe and concrete, Joanna was in the possession of a pearl necklace worth 20,000 florins. It was not hers. It was owned by three other people given to her to sell. She fakes a home burglary, staging that the pearls were stolen, and blames the maid, like classic horrible thing to do. The maid is questioned for 3 days and later released. Joanna is later found wearing one of the strings of the pearls. I guess there were three string of pearls on the necklace total, two of which she managed to sell to other people. And when she's interrogated by the police, she later confesses. All the pearls are recovered and eventually returned. At her trial, it emerges that she had many unresolved debts, and she is convicted of embezzlement and framing her maid. Let's see, a little more. So the court sentences Joanna to 1 year of what's called severe imprisonment. By this, it's meant that she would be placed in leg irons, limited to a meatless diet, forced to sleep on bare boards on the floor, and not allowed to converse with anyone but her jailers. Through the intervention of her husband at the time, it's a different husband at this time, the sentence is gradually reduced, first down to 2 months, then down to just one, and in the end, thanks to an appeal from the emperor, end time she had already served for previous things before the trial, her crime, like the theft in 1804, is later used in Beethoven's lawsuits against her for custody of Carl. I'm almost done. So Carl, he has a happy ending mostly. Carl leaves the military in 1832 and is happily married, has four daughters and one son. He names the son Ludwig. So he must not have totally hated Beethoven, we think, but mostly did. Carl dies age 52 from liver disease. His wife outlives him by 33 years. And this is the saddest part, his mother, Joanna, outlives both her son, Carl, and Beethoven. And that's what happened today. So, I don't know if you knew.
That happened today.
All that happened on January 9th when this episode was released. Sorry to punish you guys through all of that, but I just thought it was so interesting.
No, like, but that's so interesting. Yeah,
like, and Beethoven scholars think, like, this is a much bigger deal for Beethoven than any of his, like, hearing stuff or anything. Or at least it's very underrated as, like, a big deal for him. Yeah, but he's certainly the bad guy. Like, it's just very, very clear. Like, dude, okay, maybe she, like, stole, but you're, like, a total prick. Like, you know, like, it's just, yeah, very, very clear, I think.
So opinionated.
Very opinionated.
Yes, of course. I have a hard time now going back to anything that's regular life or music with all this death and murder and
so sad, right? Anyway, but I just jumped at the chance because it just happened to, yeah, that was his first winning of Carl's custody. It happened January 9th.
Okay, well then I'm gonna pull a Ben and say, okay, Conrado, our other friend to be here, so he left a message for you and he said, hi Conrado, I'm so sorry I couldn't join today. I have long admired your beautiful playing with Kashka, and I was happy to catch a glimpse of you at the Marimba One booth a couple of years ago at PASIC. A while back, we had an interesting discussion with Francesca Sant'Angelo regarding the difference in sensitivities between different players. Broadly, we spoke to American players' sense of precision and European players' sense of beautiful sound. Do you feel that this is an accurate portrayal, being the only Spanish marimba player that we in the US are familiar with? Could you describe your approach to the instrument and perhaps how you arrived there? In my observation, you carry that beautiful mass of European sound coupled with passion that could perhaps come from a Spaniard.
Oh, Ben.
There you go. Work with it.
Well, okay. You know, I think, I mean, that's so interesting, actually, the question and everything. And the whole thing, we could talk for ages about this. But I could even say even more. I mean, in this question, we are talking about, he's talking about America or United States and Europe. But even between Europe, I don't know that much about America or the United States. But in Europe, you can feel the difference between the way of playing marimba or any instrument anyway. In France, Germany, and Spain, for example, there is already a big difference and a different approach and a different way of feeling it. Yeah. And I think it has to be also with the character. And this is very normal. Also, you can realize it very easily if this is a Russian pianist or a French pianist. No, it's like very obvious. Yeah? I think with marimba, it's happening exactly the same. But then there is something that maybe also because of the cultural development of any nation, yeah, this affects directly also to the way of understanding or feeling the music. And also to expressing the music, you know, and this can really condition the way that we not just play, but that we develop the music in our country. And I'm sure, for example, in Germany in the beginning of 20th century and now, the way of playing is completely different because the way of feeling the nation and the way of feeling of, you know, life there in this country is completely different also, no? And now also because of the 20th or 21st century, we are traveling so much, it's much easier for us to travel and to have lessons, or not lessons, but to listen to concerts, you know, from people from worldwide, yeah? So it's much easier to get inspired or to get involved in one way of playing or the other way of playing. So right now we are more mixed, I think. And for example, many people told me that in Spain it was pretty much French style and kind of more sensitive in a way. So I was the crazy one who was hitting the marimba as hell. Yeah, no, something like this. But yeah, but I was actually more into the German, Russian, Polish way of sound. Yeah. But the difference is that now, after, I don't know, 10 years or something, there's much more people, and not just because I'm doing this, but also because a lot of information from, you know, great marimbistas, Kashka, Bogdan, some others from Europe are coming. Also Svet, you know, who is actually in Miami, but he was traveling a lot. Svet Stoyanov, I mean, yeah, he was traveling a lot also to Europe and giving lessons there, and then he inspired a lot of people also there, or people who were staying in Miami and came back to Europe or whatever. So now we are much more mixed in this way, no? And I don't like to talk about the way of playing in Spain or the United States or France, because I think right now we can choose whatever we want, and we can choose the sound and the way, and of course we cannot choose how we feel the music because we just feel it and that's it, but we can somehow train it, no? I think this is my opinion, of course. Of course, there is something very natural in every person and how we play and the way of playing, right? But we can choose which way we want to do it and which way we want to make it more, you know, how to say, enhance some feeling or just stop some other feeling, which maybe will not help us. I don't know. Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, when borders open, all these lines, these big contrasts between mm-hmm. people and ways of expression and cultures start to disappear. They start to blend more. So,
yeah. Yes, I think, and this is, I think, one of the most beautiful things of 21st century, honestly. Yeah. It's open our minds. So we are not thinking about what people think in my town or in my city or in my country, but what people think in the whole world. So we need to open much more, right?
Yeah. Okay, we have one final question for you, unless Carly or Casey, you have something to add. But so you are currently the marimba professor in Centro Superior Progreso Musical, right, in Madrid? And I was just wondering, other than, you know, teaching music and the instrument, how do you mentor your students in their pursuit of a career? Say that, you know, you do everything, you do chamber music, you are marimba soloist in front of orchestras, and you play recitals. How do you help out kids who say, hey, I want to be in front of an orchestra one day, you know, I want to play just like you? What do you do with that? How do you help them actually make that career?
Well, great question. Also, if someone say I want to play like you, I would say don't lose your time, because you should play like you. And actually, what the world actually needs is new people and new ideas, not to repeat. And this is one of the biggest problems also, especially now that everything is so easy and you can just go to YouTube or Vimeo or something and watch and repeat, but you don't think. What do you want? No? So the first thing I always say to my students is, what do you want? And I think this is one of the biggest questions and most difficult questions for anyone. Don't try to repeat me, don't repeat what I'm doing, but try to think, what do you want? Because this is possibly the biggest thing that you can offer to the world, right? And this is actually the biggest door of your career. If you can offer something different, something very personal, this is actually the biggest thing. And for example, someone who is playing, as you said, you know, you're playing timpani, you're playing orchestra study, you're playing chamber music, you're playing marimba, snare drum, everything. I mean, we have such a big world, right? And some of them say one day, okay, I want to try orchestra. The only thing I say, okay, then try it, but 100% go for it. And then if it doesn't work, we will see. But the only thing you need to do is to really focus on what you want right now. I mean, and this is never late to do it, you know. Right now is never late to do anything. So you can just go try to do it, but put all your energy, because right now the world is so big and we are so many percussionists. I mean, we are really a lot, and the world is big. So you need to do something very special, I think. This is the biggest thing I can actually advise to any of my students. You need to do something special, and the biggest thing, I mean, or at least for me, the most special thing is actually to show what you really are, not what are you learning from someone, but from this information, how do you transform everything to make it personal, to make it real, to make it your way of understanding this bit, or just understanding the, you know, say, I don't know, we were talking about Beethoven, but how do you understand the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, the timpani part, for example, I don't know, right? When you go to a Probespiel, how is in English this, sorry, this is in German, but when you go to proof in an orchestra to get the place, yeah, the timpani place, and there are or hundreds of people that want this place, the timpani place, yeah, you need to make something very special, you need to make something very, very personal that will make the difference. Of course, you need to be correct, you need to know the style, you need to know how at that time they wanted to sound it, but also you need to know, okay, what are they looking for in this orchestra, or how this orchestra normally sounds. This is France or Germany or New York, where are you, no? Which kind of sound they are looking for, and then what can I add to this? So when you have this base, you have this, all these details, then what is you, no? What it makes very special your way of playing, that they will choose you between 80 people, for example. No, and I think this is the most important thing and one of the most scary things, because sometimes you say, okay, so how to start with this? No, and this is difficult, of course, I know. And I was also in this point, I didn't know how to start. But I think just accepting that you are not exactly your professor or the person that inspires you, but you have learned from this person and you have a lot of things already learned, and now you can also develop something new. And it's difficult and it's heavy, but the same way, I think it's the most beautiful thing in arts in general. No. What can you offer to the instrument, to the music, to make it keep growing and not just be stable without moving, just in case? No.
Yeah. I want a lesson. Can I have a lesson? This is awesome. That's such nice and good words. My teachers were always like, Casey, you didn't learn everything I told you to. Go back and practice harder. That was the end of the talk. That's really great. Thanks for just sharing really good words.
I mean, this is my pleasure. This is something very you know, I didn't learn this from anyone, but also maybe I learned it from everyone who was teaching me in some point, because I had many different professors and I went to so many master classes, you know, everyone who was coming close to me, or when I was able to travel already, I was old enough to travel alone. No, I was also going to all my the master classes I could. And what I actually learned was exactly this. Whoever is really active, you know, and is giving masterclass Sunday, they normally never try you to play exactly as they want, but they try to give you information to make your own way of understanding the piece. They give you all the information about the piece, about the period, about the composer, whatever. Yeah, and they try to help you to solve problems, but then they need to open the door to say, okay, and what is your next step? No, what is important for you to, you know, to point out here or there, right? And this was one of my biggest shocks when I went out of the music school, that I also had this kind of professor, as you said, no, that you are not playing exactly what I said. I said, yeah, but I don't feel it like that, and I don't know how to play it exactly like you, yeah, because I don't feel that. And then I went to someone else and say, okay, that's nice. It sounds very you. I say, okay, cool. No, so finally I know how do I sound, no, because I didn't know it. No, yeah, that was important for me to know.
That's excellent. Thanks so much for joining us today. And just, man, that episode flew by. So, yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really my pleasure. It's a great conversation with you three.
Yeah, gosh, likewise. And yeah, Ksenia, great snag. Thanks for booking him. And Carly, great to see you as always. Cool. All right, everybody, we're going to record. God, we're going to record the next episode in like 20 minutes, actually. So, but I'll pretend like we won't see you again for another week. So, yeah, catch you on episode 112. And okay, thanks, everyone.